as presented by Dr. Lewin, says that the chairperson has not responded to the invitation and to, you know, the proposal made by the department last 2019, I think, you know, was it last year or 2019, which is a serious concern, chairperson. And the chairperson at the time is no longer there now. And I think I want to mix this one with the point you just made now, that the department, the university does not speak about the consequence management. Consequence management means those who have put us in the mess we are in today are going to be attended to in this session. And these are those people. So that is what we mean by consequence management. And that is what we, you know, require from the university. So yeah, that is what on consequence management I want to talk about. I think one or two, Chair, the university's academic year has commenced at UNISA, and some students have not yet, who received provisional acceptance, are still waiting for confirmation, and assignments are being submitted. How are they? How are UNISA going to make sure that those students are assisted if and when they get confirmation or confirmed as a registered students? So I'm just talking about those who are now in limbo, who got provisional acceptance or registered, but you know, they are not yet registered. How is the university going to ensure that those students are covered? I think it's important also to note, chairperson, that the point you just made, that we are not saying the numbers must be reduced because we are against access to higher education. That is not the intention here. The intention is to make sure that, you know, in line with our 2030 targets of students at higher institutions, institutions of higher learning reach a certain number. But, you know, we want to make sure that we gradually increase those numbers. We don't increase numbers and then we're unable to assist those numbers academically, but also we're unable to assist them financially to conclude their studies. So I think at that point you made it very clear. It was one of the points that I wanted to speak about. I heard the SRC talking about phasing out, if I heard correctly, of certificate program, and I want to differ with them there, because I think certificate program provides an articulation pathway to higher education bachelor degrees and diploma qualifications for many students who will not necessarily have access to higher education if these programs were not offered. And therefore, I want to you know, plead with them that this should not be phased out or taken out, because, you know, a lot of students who some of us know who now have degrees and have went on to complete their masters, they went through these articulation programs of higher education in the higher education space. And I want to plead with everybody to not close doors for those ones. So the higher education, the current higher education funding model seems not to be suitable for distance learning. And I'm sure Tandy, Dr. Lewin, you will agree with me here. and if we are to now subject it to one size fits all, sorry, we're going to have a lot of problems, especially with this one of funding. I think so we must agree that UNISA, and this should be the task team that I think you guys are talking about now, with the department, UNISA, and NSFAS, should sit down and form a So this task team that will look at a new funding model for UNISA, specifically because UNISA caters for a different, it's not like any other of our 25 universities. It's different. It's it caters for different kinds of students, and I think that task team should sit down and look at the funding models that will best work here at UNISA. COVID-19 happened, and a few weeks ago we had the University of Zululand chairperson, where the vice chancellor and the council said, when it hits University of Zululand, the rural university like the University of Zululand, they did not know what to do. But through the help of UNISA, they managed to distribute learning materials to students across the country, because UNISA has got that capacity across the country. And therefore, I think we must thank UNISA for playing that role, including assisting their sister competition, including the University of Zululand. The university in one slide said, in trying to mitigate against these problems of
over-enrollment,
thank you very much. They said one of their thinking about introducing registration fees, and I want to disagree with them and inform them that a lot of our people who go to institutions of higher learning really are from the poorest of the poor, who will be closed out if you introduce that. And I think it will not serve the people. And I want to plead with them not to implement. They must rather think about something else, Chair, because this one really is not going to assist. And lastly, Chair, which is, I've not really seen one problem on this one at UNISA, but it looks like it's a problem across other universities. And I want them. I'm asking for their indulgence, UNISA. A lot of time when there are strikes at institutions of higher learning, students will cry that they've been funded for 2019, 2020, and this year they are told they are not funded because of one reason or the other. So I want to understand. And when we go deeper here, Chair, we find out that institutions submit incorrect information of students to NSFAS, and never NSFAS takes a wrong decision based on the information provided for by the university. So I want to ask the universities, and the SRC can assist us here if they also have such problems at UNISA, so that we can really get to the problem, to the bottom of the problem here. Do we have such problems at UNISA? Do you guys submit information of students to NSFAS on time? Because in other institutions, NSFAS still has not received results of students from 2019, and we're now starting the academic year of 2021. And if so, what is the problem? Maybe let's try to understand this problem from your side as an institution. Why does it take so long for the universities to communicate effectively with NSFAS so that students don't end up suffering the consequence of a mismanagement, really, of coming from university management and NSFAS. And I think, Chairperson, I think those were my questions and comments, but I just want to congratulate everybody who's here and wish them well at UNISA. Make sure that they work with the biggest and the largest stakeholders at that institution, which are students, and make sure that they don't stifle them, they don't stifle debate, they don't suspend them unnecessarily. They just create the working relations, because the students are the most important people at that institution. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tambo.
Thank you very much, Chair.
maybe just to afford the our guests the same respect they've been affording us, just to show face, and then so that they know that they're not speaking to ghosts, but actual people. And then I will switch off the video, of course, because of the network as well. I think I'd like to welcome the presentation from the department, UNISA, as well as the SRC. It gave us a lot to think about, especially with regards to the situation in the institution in general that we've had to, over the past couple of months, witness through media platforms, particularly the court case, which is something we observed as well on media. So I came with an intention to fight, but unfortunately, I think I've been subdued a little bit by the presentation with regards to the approach UNISA has taken. I don't have many qualms with it. So I think my approach is going to primarily to be more on to engage more on a political level with the issues that have been presented to us today. Because I think there's debates that I think we need to have as a committee ourselves with the department, with UNISA, and generally on policy perspectives that ought to guide government in terms of how we approach issues relating to enrollment, funding, access to higher education, and consequent management with regards to that. And of course, I think there's a conversation that we need to have as well with regards to how institutions of higher learning are receptive or non-receptive to either critique or state intervention. Because there's a common thread or trend that I notice with regards to how institutions of higher learning are receptive to interventions in their operation. It's something I picked up when the legal representative of UNISA was speaking. But that's something I think I'll deal with later in the end. So just at a conceptual level, I think something that we must be able to avoid as public representatives deployed by the masses of our people, the electorate primarily, to represent them and their interests, that as much as we are in charge of the rolling out of bureaucratic responsibilities and administrative tasks, which are regulated by things like the Higher Education Act and all relevant statutes and legislation, we must be careful of becoming technocratic. We must be careful of becoming people who are primarily administrators rather than servants of our people. And I'm not saying this as an accusation to anyone. It's just an overarching caution. Because when we think about the enrollment of students to higher education, the higher education sector, I would argue, in many respects, is one of the most complex sectors in our society, which is why it's always confronting day-to-day problems. I remember I spoke to Honorable Lise on the side when we were a bit frustrated as to when we're opening our committee to deal with the day-to-day running of oversight in terms of education, that we're not a sector that can often afford to take long breaks or be on extensive recesses, because it's a sector that is ever evolving and changing problems. As much as those problems might be the same year to year, you'll find that they are constant and they require a level of flexibility in terms of addressing them. And I think the enrollment issue is one of those. Because in my understanding, an administration that is run by public servants must be able to mold itself in accordance with the demands for education in this regard. So the demands for access to education must never be suppressed in order to keep administrative ducks in a row. I think that's my point of departure. When I think about the enrollment saga, I am cautious of us prioritizing keeping administrative ducks in a row over and above the hunger for education in South Africa, because then we pose the risk of becoming a bureaucracy or government that exists for its own sake. So it exists to be able to give good reports at the end of terms to say we met our targets in this regard, we're able to constrain this in this regard. And I think when it comes to access to education, that must be something that we're extremely cautious of. That keeping our ducks in a row must not supersede the needs of our people. So I think that that's the point at which I will depart. And I think it's a bit, one of the reasons I'm a bit disappointed that the minister is not here, because he was leading the charge with regards to this recommendation of a reduction of 20,000 first-time entrants at Venus. I think it's a mechanical approach of dealing with human beings, and of course a developmental key indicator in the form of education, dealing with this as if it exists only in paper and not in reality, especially considering the history of our society and who has been allowed to gain access to education and who has not historically. I think it's a gravely concerning that there's a possibility that we may be instruments of suppressing education in the hunger for education in our country. So I just think conceptually, to think about the enrollment issue, we must think about it in that regard, that we must just tread carefully from becoming technocrats that serve a bureaucracy devoid of political nuance, if you were to put it correctly. Because the argument that I think the EFF Students Command, the African Human Rights Commission, and the Black Lawyers Association student chapter, I hope I've termed them correctly, was that we understood from the arguments that they made that UNISA is one of the most efficient open distance learning institutions, not only in the continent but in the world. And the model that UNISA operates on must be a model that the entire tertiary sector in South Africa ought to draw inspiration from, especially under the current COVID-19 conditions that I think will be with us for the foreseeable future. Because in terms of ICT infrastructure, of course, there will always be room for improvement. But the mere fact that that is one of the most central aspects of how UNISA operates means that they are not tied down to the constraints of residence buildings, lecture halls, and all sorts of physical infrastructure that plague crisis in terms of other institutions where learning is primarily face-to-face. So that's an advantage that UNISA has. And I think that must be the approach that the general tertiary sector ought to adopt. And UNISA is a case study that you must protect in that regard, especially when we're talking about enrollment. So maybe also just to put it out there, the perspective that I'm submitting is not one that is anti-planning, of course, but rather let's be flexible and people-orientated in our approach, because matters such as, consequence measures like punitive instruction of reducing the intake by 20,000 to punish previous years' supposed over-enrollment, I don't think they're helpful. I don't think they're helpful, and it doesn't bode well in terms of the political posture that we're taking as people who are tasked with ensuring the services that deliver to our people, especially at the level of education. Now, I'm going to ask that what exactly are these consequence measures that are put in place when an institution is not compliant, things like its enrollment planning. But I'm thankful that the chairperson was able to touch on that in terms of apparently in a previous year, I think they said 2017 or 16, that funding is withheld, about 66 million of funding was withheld. I disagree with that completely, and I think it's something we must look into. I think it's completely anti-education, because when you withhold funding from an institution, it's not necessarily the institution that suffers its students. It's workers, the stakeholders of that institution. So for consequence measures of those in management, or for the consequence measures for those in management to have the most brutal impact on stakeholders who are not part of decision-making at a large scale or at a broader scale, is a very dangerous thing. I think we must be able to hold individuals accountable for their failure to be compliant outside of subjecting an entire institution to consequences for the actions of individuals or failures of individuals to operate in a compliant manner. I think that's something that we must be able to look into as well. And I think I saw at the end of the presentation by the department that there's a legal consideration of appealing the ruling by the court. And there's consultation with regards to that. After the adverse finding that has already gone, that has already been made, of course, which led to costs being placed on the department, which in itself is also embarrassing. I think it's embarrassing that there's even a consideration to pursue any further litigation on the part of the department. And I think that's something we must advise them to not do. I don't think there's time for that, and I think even for them to have a posture of pursuing litigation and wasting resources in a fight to decrease student enrollment, I don't understand, like, politically. That's why I was interested in the minister being there. Politically, how do you posture yourself in that regard? You are standing, you are pursuing litigation to decrease enrollment of students instead of formulating a comprehensive plan to accommodate or intervene in the situation that currently exists or that presents itself as it is. I mean, you are fighting against enrollment. I can understand that there's budgeting that needs to be considered and all of these things, but over and above perhaps making room to consider such, you'd rather take a political posture of opposing enrollment of people in higher education. I think it's just ill-advised. I think it's an incorrect attitude, and I think it doesn't bode well in terms of how society in general may view. I'm not sure if the minister is concerned about how he's viewed anymore, but I don't think it bodes well in terms of the posture that the Department of Higher Education in a country that postures itself to be developmental, to take such a position, I think is ill-advised and something that the department must reconsider. And I think the same goes for UNICEF, because I listened to the point made about the consideration, or I'm sure it's already been undertaken, appealing what they call it's Order 3.3, I think, which related to the order to retain the semester system by the court, or the registration of courses in the two semester tiered process. I think, in my view now, I mean, we're not giving legal advice or anything with that regard. I'm just making an observation. But in my view, I think it just amounts to frivolous litigation and possibly an attempt to place institutional autonomy above constitutional or judicial provisions in our country. And this is why I wanted to make the point about how institutions of higher learning in South Africa don't seem receptive to intervention that is not from within the institution itself. And I think it's a very narcissistic attitude that institutions of higher learning in South Africa have. Because to make a determination that there's judicial overreach when a court makes a determination on matters relating to a university, on the basis that institutional expertise is being undermined, is narcissism in my view. Because institutional expertise is subjective. It's subjective to who constitutes that institution. It's subjective to who are the people, what are their political outlooks, what are their understandings of what is necessary to take care of stakeholders and all of those sorts of things. And in the case or instance that institutional expertise can be at odds with constitutional rights or values or the interests of stakeholders, those must be challenged to present decisions or decision-making systems of a university as expertise seem to suggest that any intervention outside of that is mediocre or ill-informed or ignorant. And I think it's something that you must address just at a conceptual level. Because when a public institution receives adverse findings in that regard, I find it a bit petty to create judicial overreach and wasteful to further pursue any more litigation. Particularly in an instance like this of how do you structure registration. I sincerely don't see the value of UNISA pursuing this so passionately. Maybe they can expand in their responses. But I wanted us to speak against this tendency of institutions of higher learning in South Africa to villainize state intervention in academic affairs. And I think this was a perfect opportunity to correct that. Because institutions of higher learning seem to think that because they are sites of knowledge production, they are infallible. And any intervention on how they operate comes from people or institutions that are inferior to them or do not understand how academia ought to operate. Something that we must correct. It's a common thing. I mean, we were student activists. I'll make an example with the call to boycott academic ties in Israel. The common term that was thrown around whenever we would make this call would be that, and the term that would be thrown around would be to maintain, of course, relations with what we deem an immoral relationship with a state that is perpetuating human rights violations, is a term known as academic freedom. And I think it's just another phrase for institutional expertise. I genuinely think it's one of the mechanisms that avoids transformation, that avoids state intervention, and of course, villainize the state, without an understanding that government is constituted by the will of the people. It's something that we encounter even in in what is this committee, the ad hoc committee for the amendment of section 25 to allow for land expropriation without compensation. The most prevalent presentation by civil society was these independently conducted surveys. And these independently conducted surveys masquerade or operate under the guise of being some form of technical expertise. And this technical expertise that posits itself or positions itself as superior to a constitutionally and democratically constituted parliament or judiciary or any process that is constituted through that stems its root or existence from an electorate is something that we need to speak out against. And I think that it's one of the things that institutions of higher learning in this country suffer from. They seem to think that their institutional expertise exists in a bubble outside of our democratic body. So I'm not saying this because institutions must not resist adverse litigation against them based on their own assessments. They can. I mean, I think it's just a debate. But this thing of judicial overreach versus institutional expertise, it's just fucked an alarm in me because of the logic that institutions in this country seem to think that they're beyond reproach because they encapsulate some God-given knowledge that the rest of us as an electorate, as a democracy, must just abide to. I just wanted to make those observations, Chair. There's not, because generally I think the institution is trying its best. But I just think that, as I said in the beginning, we must avoid being technocrats and we must be flexible in the sector that is extremely complex. And of course, that's the word of caution on what I think is frivolous litigation to pursue on this issue of the two-tiered system of registration. Other than that, I think I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Tambo. Honorable King.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation that was given to us, and also to give some clarity on the matter that we're dealing with. Also listening to what was just said by Honorable Pombo, you should be mindful also, as the university well know, that I wrote a letter in January already when this thing surfaced, asking them to give us clarity on why they've actually taken this decision. I've also written to NEFSA to ask why would NEFSA then at the end of the day fund some students above the threshold that they have for each university. And it was actually shocking that the university, only after a Daily Maverick article in January the 15th came to fall on the letter that I sent to them, constantly then contacted me, asking me to actually wait. They are still busy in discussing with the minister. So when you say you are going to appeal this matter, I do understand that you would appeal it on the basis of keeping the autonomy of the university intact, which I feel is very important to do because we should never undermine the autonomy of any university or any higher education institution. But when we consider the case, would we also then say the minister's action to direct instead of saying these are the penalties that you will then incur, was that not also impeding on the autonomy of higher education institutions? So that's a question we should also be looking at. But the question, the most serious question that we should be looking at when we look at UNISA's over-enrollment is why is it then for UNISA so easy to go against the very policies and legal acts of our country to over-enroll and not heed the call of the department to say these are only the amount of numbers you should enroll, why did you over-enroll, and these are the proper consequences. Because the Higher Education Act, according to my knowledge, is also a bit silent and it's a bit vague because it just basically states penalties. I think that is a gray area where we should be looking at, to alter that part or amend that part to say these are actually the type of penalties that will be instituted instead of just a financial penalty. So When we also look at UNISA going forward, I'm glad that they are going to adhere to it. But what then stops them from doing this in 2022 again, 2023? Is it then that we are looking at now when they say autonomy of the university, we are looking now to say, how many lecturers do we have as compared to students per lecturer? What are the ratio of that? To say that, okay, universities at this faculty will have maybe 5,000 students. So those are the things that we should seriously consider looking at and have proper discussions with all institutions. Because when a university over-enrolls 20,000 students, at the end of the day, the NEFSA will then have to pay more funding to some of those students, which will then have a ripple effect on other institutions. Because as we know, NEFSA don't have enough funds to go around. So if they were to pay more to UNISA, it means then that a university, let's say UWC, might have to go with less funding. So that is the consequences that we should also be looking at. It is not just a matter of enrolling because we want to enroll so many students. And I was glad to see in the presentation that UNISA is reaching out to TVET colleges. And that is actually the way we should be going now. We should actually strengthen the curriculum and strengthen the resources of TVET colleges so that universities like UNISA is not actually put in a situation where they end up enrolling more students than what they currently have because of the demand that is out there. So those are the questions we should be having, but also be mindful that universities need to have their autonomy. And I disagree with what was previously said, that we are taking above what students want. We need that autonomy and we need regulations at an institution in order to safeguard political interference at some stage. Thank you.
Honorable King, I see there is another hand of the General Secretary of the SRC. Unfortunately, this opportunity was open for members, Shatadi. It only members who engages with the presentation. The SRC is coming here as a stakeholder to respond or to give us your own perspective to respond to the issues. So the reason why we put you at the end is so that you can be able to engage with the other issues that are presented earlier on. So when your opportunity arises to respond, we will then give you that opportunity to engage. But for now, let's recognize the members only. Honorable Mkacha, I see your hand.
good afternoon, colleagues, from UNISA to the leadership of the students of the SRC, represented by the SG of the SRC and the president. Thank you very much to all of you for your presentation. Chair, I've by and large been covered by other members, but perhaps the only sentiment I'd like to share, I don't think I have any questions per se, but the only sentiment that I would like to share is that I think the matter at hand is beyond UNISA. I think it's very clear that the demand for access to higher education is increasing. And we as stakeholders in the sector should be looking at how we expand access. So how do we, for example, strengthen the TVET program for it to be able to absorb more students and for it to actually produce graduates who can be active participants of our economy? That's the question that's been on our minds since, you know, before the presentation of the APP, but that's basically the sentiment of the portfolio committee, to strengthen the TVET program. In terms of expanding access, we look at the two universities that are about to be built in Mekurhuleni and the other one in Namangskraal as well. That's also expanding access, but the demand is immediate. The demand is not in 5 years' time, or, you know, we don't have the time frames of which, of when these particular universities would be built. So what do we do in the meantime? Therefore, interventions of strengthening our infrastructure development projects to ensure that they're successful in the PVET program and that funds allocated are then not used. That's very important because we need to access, we need to strengthen and increase the capacity of institutions taking more students because the demand is only going up. And I think honorable members are by and large agreeing that turning back students cannot be the solution. What we need to be talking about as stakeholders in the sector is how do we increase access? And I think then a question then goes to UNISA to say that if DHET didn't give you, well, let me ask it like this. Does UNISA think it has the capacity to increase enrollment beyond the plan of DHET? And if we were to look into the immediate future, if we were to look into 2022, in terms of what Honorable Tambo has then spoken to, in how the structure of UNISA is, which is predominantly, I guess, remote learning, do we have capacity to increase our capabilities of being able to enroll more students? But I think centralizing the demand or pressure to UNISA is also flawed for us as a sector. We should be looking at how we perhaps strengthen other institutions to take on a more remote sort of hybrid method of teaching and learning that could perhaps bring in more students into those particular institutions. I really think this moment from the get-go for me was beyond UNISA. And Chair, right at the beginning of the sixth administration, this portfolio committee spoke about how we create a sort of ecosystem that is interdependent and that is, I don't know, core supportive, where the TVET program, the university program, the CET program can all in some form piggyback on each other for it to support one another. So for example, in alleviating pressure to accommodation, you know, the conversation around building academic hubs or centers in communities where your CET students can benefit from it, your TVET students could benefit from it, and the university students could also benefit from it, as to decentralize the pressure from a particular institution of higher learning. So I really think for me, Chair, this moment calls, really pushes for the sector to be innovative and proactive on how we expand access post-COVID. And I think the post-COVID moment is a moment that can honestly force us to, maybe we've been unable to think about how rapidly we can move in expanding access in more innovative ways and not thinking about the physical class. And COVID has shown us that there are ways of which education can be increased. And I mean, UNISA was used by and large as a pilot to say, how do we ensure teaching and learning continues in the era of COVID, but at the same time, we saw what the limitations were in terms of access to information and communication technology. So what will it then take us as a sector to ensure that we can then move into a higher education sector that is more encompassing of ITC infrastructure to support hybrid or remote learning? So I think right now is a moment for us to really introspect and reflect and move very, very fast, because what we can't have is a situation where in the next year we're having the same conversation. And this also goes generally to a conversation, I guess, around our state of readiness at the beginning of each year, where we're always in shock that students need funding. It's just, I never understand that. But Chair, I really think that for me, my take home from the conversation we've had today is that the demand for access to higher education is only but increasing, and we have to respond rapidly as a sector. Where it's an issue, and I think, Chair, it also exacerbates the conversation around how urgent it is for the budget of this particular portfolio to be increased in order for us to do the work that we need to do. But also for those funds of which are existent in the sector to be used, or in the portfolio to be used for what they're meant to be used for, because wasteful expenditure is also a thing, and also a thing in the space, and people are doing whatever they want to do with taxpayers' money. So I think for me, Chair, yeah, that those will be my sentiments. I've by and large been covered by other honourable members. Thank you so much, Chair.
Okay, I think members have engaged with all the various presentations. So it will be an opportunity for UNISA and for the department to respond to the issues that were raised, the questions that were raised. Just a few things from myself, just to conclude the question session or the engagement session. I think there are a number of lessons that we should learn from this situation. One of the things that should be encouraged is that decisions, especially decisions that relate to policy, must be arrived at after having carefully gone through the processes. The system should not be shocked, and then we should respond to the shock as an incident that has to be acceptable in terms of what the policy should be. Meaning that the system as it is, it's quite complex, as members are saying, and therefore requires thorough planning. And for me, the idea of developing enrollment plans was to facilitate the gradual increase and management in the system. So you manage how the system can be able to absorb the student population whilst at the same time making sure that you maintain the system. The system become operational in terms of resourcing and all of that. And so this departure from planning, especially for an academic institution like UNISA, it's something that must really be frowned upon. Because an institution as big as this one will rely heavily on what are the plans. So every time we go to the next academic year, we plan for enrollment, we plan for the teaching and academic program, allocation of resources, we plan for everything. Now, I don't understand, for instance, why are we not, were we not able, or was UNISA not able to comply with its own plans? Because it means that if you don't comply with your own plans on the enrollment, you are not going to comply with the other plans that you have. Because if you are able to treat this important part in the life of the university in the manner that it was treated, it can be very easy, therefore, not to comply with the other plans, including the budget itself, because the budget is a plan on how you're going to spend the resources that we have. So everything in an institution, in fact, the entirety of government is premised along planning. Everything that we do in Parliament, in the executive, early in February, we received the presentation of the budget. Subsequent to that, we get departments to brief us on their plans. And then we consider the appliance in relation to how money has been allocated. We vote on it. Towards the end, we will be considering the reports. The departments will be coming to report to us. So the cycle, the entire cycle is around planning. And how an academic institution as big as UNISA cannot comply with its own plans is something that is still something to be... I don't understand how that can be the case. And we are not told as to what are the consequences for that. Who's taking responsibility for not complying with this? But as part of this engagement and this conversation around UNISA, a point was made earlier on that there is a concern around the throughputs at UNISA, the pass rate, how many students are entering the system, how many of them are exiting the system with qualifications. And we were told that throughout the country, and probably, yeah, say, let's just limit ourselves to the country. So throughout the country, UNISA receives the lowest sort of throughput. Is that the case? What gives rise to this kind of a situation that relates to, shouldn't our focus and our preoccupation be on quality? That the students that get into the system, the intake, we make sure that there is quality throughout the academic year. Then the possibilities, we make it possible that the greater number of students who get into the system exit the system with qualification, rather than focusing on quantity. It's correct to broaden access to higher education. But if only 3 of the 10 that gets into the system ultimately get out with qualification, is that not resulting in the cost to the system and to the state? Does it not call into us to pause and to reflect whether where are our priorities? Where are our priorities? What is the problem in the system? Is it about teaching and learning? Is it about the methodology that we use? What is the problem in experiencing that kind of a situation? So I would like to get some comments from the university with regard to that. But I must say that I'm still not entirely satisfied about the explanation that we receive on the question of consequences, for instance, on the question of exactly what has happened. Who took, because at the beginning, in fact, as part of the slides, Professor, I think, Lofu says, what was in terms of the ministerial determination, in terms of the enrollment plan and council decisions. So whoever who did this thing was working outside of what council had approved. So who in the system is responsible for that? I want to get to understand that one. And probably, I think, at a later stage, I think we might also have to get a view from the department. What is the final decision with respect to the issue which is the subject of the court? But I think finally, I am not sure whether the department has discussed this thing extensively. I'm worried about the impact that this may have entirely in the system with the other universities, and the extent to which the universities may consider the enrollment plans that they discuss with the department as binding on them, as something that they have to respect, as something that should not be a tick box exercise, but it's something that has to be respected and to be implemented in view of the court outcomes. So I'm just saying that it's something that the department has to thoroughly engage with, and to see what is it that can be done going forward. But otherwise, those are the questions. I think we've already made our point about this is not about access. Definitely not. It's not about access. It's about planning for access. Planning how you expand access to higher education. Because without the plans, the entire system will collapse. The entirety of government is dependent on the resources that are there. You can't want to spend more than what you have, otherwise you will result in a situation where of a fiscal cliff that Honorable Boshoff was talking about yesterday. Okay, we will open for this time. I think we'll start with UNISA, the SRC, and then get the department. But there are a few questions to the SRC, but if in case SRC wants to engage us, you've got an opportunity to do that. Chair of Council.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me start off by saying that the way you've summarized it is correct. I mean, nobody can argue with what you've said about planning, budgeting, and so forth. I'm an accountant by profession, Chairperson. So those things, it's something that indeed you cannot run organizations without complying with them. So we don't take this lightly, Chairperson, but unfortunately some of us, we find ourselves in the middle of these things, but we don't take it lightly. And you also talk about the consequence management. I mean, the financial implications of this is serious. So we don't take it lightly. What I can, some assurance I can give you when it comes to consequence management is that management is busy with their own processes. But Dr. Magasela is here, who is the chairperson of the Academic and Student Affairs Committee of Council. They will be monitoring that. So maybe I think, Chair, maybe we might not be able to answer you exactly today, but if maybe the committee could give us some time, be it a month or so, because obviously there would be a lot of work that needs to be done to see how it got here, who was responsible and so forth. So maybe if you could give us a time of a month or two, we could write back to you and provide you with a report of what has happened and the definitive consequence management that took place. But the point is well noted, and I don't think there's anyone here, in at least in our team, who can dispute that there's no way that we can have a situation where we went over budget. I mean, and nothing happened. So, if Chairperson, that is fine with the committee, allow us some time, we'll write back to you and we'll give you a report on what has happened and how consequence management was implemented decisively. Chairperson, there were a couple of comments that you've made and other members that have made that I would like to respond to, and then thereafter I'll hand over to the VC to deal with the rest of the comments and questions. The first one that you've mentioned, Chairperson, is you are not clear as to how we got here. So, Prof. when I'm done speaking here, please explain the issue of the TT again, because that is the main reason why we're here. I'll try and explain it in layman's terms, because I'm not a professor. But I'll try and explain it, Chairperson. What happens is that, let's say, Chair, we have we have set a target of 100 people to take. What would happen is that come the end of registration, there's a time where payments must be made. I think Prokundo mentioned that payments must be made so that the registration is secured. Now, this PP is, especially in relation to NSFAS, that's where the problem starts. Because let's say, for example, come the end of registration and when payments are due, let's say, for example, there's 80 that have concluded their registration. But the number could be more in terms of those ones who are still waiting for NSFAS confirmation. And the problem starts there, because what happens is after we have closed, the communication that we might get from NSFAS or the students that might get from NSFAS, that can come later than the hour cutoff, and the dilemma gets created there. But I will ask Prokundo to explain it again, because I think that is one of the main reasons why we find ourselves in this situation. Chair, I also wanted to touch on the issue of the court case. I think we need to maybe we're not so clear. Chair, we are not appealing the issue of the 20,000. That one, there is a council resolution. We've taken that decision, but we're not appealing the 20,000 reduction judgment against us. We've taken that decision. The 3.3, Chairperson, and I'll ask the VC to explain, not from a legal point of view. I think that's where we might have lost, we might have not come out through clearly. The appealing 3.3, which is a sinisterization matter, it's not just a legal issue, at least by my understanding, and I would like VC to explain this part. There is also academic issues involved in that, because certain modules that you do, there's hours that are required before you can issue such qualification and so forth. So it's not just the legalese that our advocate explained, but there's also other academic reasons why we have to relook at that and not necessarily just accept it. So VC, when you respond, please explain the educational, the academic reasoning of why we need to appeal the single semester issue. Chairperson, you also spoke about, and then the our legal advisor will also touch on some of the legal comments that you've made. But I wanted to touch on the issue of EXCO and its powers. Yes, indeed, the judge did rule that EXCO didn't have the necessary powers because it should have gone to council, and the issue of Senate. On the issue of whether council should have been involved, yeah, Chair, I think in our submissions we had differed, we had submitted differently, because it would not have been the first time that EXCO has taken a decision on behalf of council. EXCO does make decisions now and then on behalf of council, but we accept the ruling of the judge, but I think in our papers we were of a view that there are instances where EXCO has those powers. On the issue of omitting Senate, Chair, that is really disappointing and it's a lesson to be learned. I think maybe because of the pressures that we had, our internal mechanism should have picked up that one. So there's no excuse about that one. But I thought I should explain the issue of EXCO versus council. We were offered a view that EXCO would have had the powers, because and from our side we are going to review our own processes, because as I'm saying, it's not the first time EXCO takes decision on behalf of council, so we'll look at it internally as well, that part. Chairperson, without wasting time, let me hand over to the VC and Prokundov to deal with the rest of the comments in that order, if it's fine with you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you very much, the chairperson of the portfolio committee and honorable members, as well as the members of council. I'd like to align with the sentiments that have been shared by the chairperson of council around our commitment to ensuring that as a university, we become a partner to the state, its aspiration for forming students as intellectuals and active participants within the knowledge arena. But we also accept that as we do so, we should comply to the requirements of the law as well as the planning systems in order that our fiduciary responsibilities, our abilities to ensure quality education within a requisite time are accomplished, but as well as that management must take the proper statutory responsibilities. On the governance matter, the chairperson, Mr. Mabua, has already stated that in terms of our statute, but also the terms or guidelines within the university system, the EXCO takes decisions in between meetings of council in the governance documents of the university. And because of the court case, we will have to revise that. We acknowledge that the sitting of the Senate is something that we could have accelerated, and this seems to have been a major challenge, which in future we will not, we commit not to to doing. The third aspect relates to the issue around the semesterization and year models. We would like to state to the honorable members of parliament and the committee that UNISA, as a comprehensive distance open e-learning university, is a confluence of universities of technology, but also research-intensive university. And precisely because of this comprehensive nature, it operates within the semester and the year modules interchangeably. And this is also an outcome of the TSA, former UNISA, and former VISTA model. In this regard, the idea of a semesterization has been a contentious one, because on the one hand, the court outcome requires for the semester, yet on the other, there is this quality question that will be asked of us. So for a particular module, there are notional hours that are required for learning and for accreditation of the credits. And in this instance, the credit systems will not manifest and will affect the quality if we accede to some of the requirements, and therefore accreditation may fall apart. The second aspect of the semester and year module question is the fact that the accreditation of professional qualifications such as engineering and others require, for instance, a semester but also sometimes a placement within the professional environment for students to ensuring empirical learning. And that's where the semester works. The final aspect around the semester and year module is that we have not called for what in the public speak or in social media spaces has been referred to as the super semester. Instead, we have requested a single registration with two semesters so that the time that is used for registration in the second semester could be dedicated for student work, student support, and academic work. In this case, we reduce the administrative processes of registering so that we increase the study time. And this is important because, as you rightly stated, Chair, the idea is not to have students access universities only, but it is to ensure that, in line with the white paper on post-school education, that we ensure that the students access and succeed within good time. And that's quite important. The third element, in response to the other issues that have been raised, we have rightly said, as part of mitigating strategies, we have realized that as the university in 2021 and the future, to ensure that we address some of the contradictions and conundrums, especially regarding the higher certificate, that it will be important that we do not look just at the imperative for UNISA sustainability and instead create engagement and a strengthening of the PSET system by ensuring that we have quality relationships with the TVET colleges, but also to ensure that when that happens, we have clear articulation levers so that students don't just do higher certificates, but they have possibilities for progression. And that's something that we have put in place and we are putting in place as a remedy to some of the challenges that we are finding around the higher certificate. The final part, Chairperson and Honourable Members of Parliament, is we truly accede and agree to the fact that as universities, we are social institutions that must be promoting access to knowledge, ideation, research, and innovation. And to this, we must ensure that we don't just teach undergraduate studies, but we also create strong participants in the postgraduate, master's and doctoral levels so that we create inventions of products, processes and ideas that change our society for the better. And for this, we think the strengthening of the TVET sector, the resourcing of the PSET system, as well as the financing mechanism, will enable us to have even stronger outputs. And therefore, this is something that we like and appreciate the fact that as the Honourable were tabling their issues, that this idea around how we strengthen the PSET system as a whole, but also the innovation system as a whole entwined with the PSET becomes a priority. Finally, my chair has rightly stated that we as a university have agreed that we cannot contest the increase to access. However, we will have to comply to the enrollment management system. As part of being accountable, we sometimes also have to take tough decisions in order to comply. And in this situation and instance, we find ourselves having to comply to the court outcome, but also to the enrollment management system, something which is going to create a challenge for our financing system and our compliance system. And that's something that we have said we will need to ensure that we comply to both. And I therefore need to request Prof. Ndlovu to then speak around how we convert a temporary registered student to a full-time student or a registered student. That challenge that we find has put us in this quagmire. And then on the consequences management, the chairperson has stated that almost all of us sitting here before you are quite new, but we have the obligation to ensure that where there have been anomalous decisions or outputs or impacts, that we rectify those and we institute mechanisms for intervention, but also holding accountable those who may not have taken the best decisions on behalf of the institutions and in compliance to the laws. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Professor Ngabule. And I think an issue is understanding how TPs impact on final enrollment, in the sense that we at UNISA, once students have been offered a place, they have to respond within 10 days. If they do, then they have to register. The challenge is that, you know, students can register at UNISA, and then we give them, and I use an example of saying, if the closing date for registration is on the 15th of the month, for instance, they have until the end of the month to pay, which will then convert their status of being a temporary registered student to a permanent registered student. So that creates a bit of a challenge, in the sense that if you don't have those students paying, therefore you are not able to meet your requirements. You have to wait until they land. And in most cases also is that it also depends on the number of offers you have made, or on the number of students that you've accepted for registration. And if you look back and think about why the under-enrollment, it's because in most cases we would simply offer up to the maximum available, and then students don't pitch after the closing date, and therefore you cannot make additional offers as such. So in the context of 2021, I made the example that currently we are sitting at 369,000 and we have 60,000 odd TPs that are open. If all those students were to accept today, effectively that would mean we'll shoot the numbers up to 430,000 or so, you know. So that's the kind of challenge that is caused by temporary registrations. What we are working towards, that we are still engaging in, and I know that the students really have a challenge with this, is that when, for you to register, you have to pay before you can register. Now that would also have a part of a challenge for NSFAS funded students, where, you know, the NSFAS would require confirmation for registration before they pay. So we would need to know who are these students that are going to be funded by NSFAS in order for us to consider them as registered students, so that we can then inform NSFAS to pay. So it does help to some extent to say, yes, I'm registered. I can now produce proof that I'm registered. Now I need payment. If that payment doesn't come through, therefore the student will lose effectively. So the balancing those two is a bit of a major challenge that causes us to lose out on either under-enrolling or over-enrolling. And that's why I say it's important that in the future we are able to actually take that decision of saying you pay, then you can register, rather than register and pay later. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, who's next?
Yes, Chairperson, from our side, we still have Advocate, but Advocate...
yes, Chairperson.
Yeah, before you come in, I'm not sure if the VC explained the reason why we need to... Maybe VC, if you want to touch on to the academic reasoning of why we need to challenge 3.3 before the advocate comes in. Why we need to challenge the semesterization and the reasoning behind it, the academic requirements that sort of give us no other option but to go that route. Please explain that before advocate comes in and deal with other legal matters.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair. The quality and qualification framework, Chair, requires that for every qualification, the students must spend particular time studying, but also getting facilitation of learning. And this is required by the Council of Higher Education as part of its qualification assessment. And therefore requires that the summative, but also other assessment practices are complied with. And it's not just the Council for Higher Education that has to do this. It's also the demands of the professional bodies that accredit professional qualifications. The second aspect related to this, which is an academic one, is that for those modules that are vocational or technical or professional, the tradition has always to divide the placement of the students to getting empirical experience or empirical research or engaged scholarship component in a semester, and then get the theorization or ideation in another semester. Whereas in some qualifications, and we currently have the Faculty of Humanities in particular, the College of Education, for instance, that already has year modules precisely to ensure that the comprehensive output and the compliance with the qualification framework are adhered to. So when we request to challenge that aspect, we are aware that it will destabilize the knowledge system and how it's articulated or how it articulates to the next level. But we also recognize that precisely because it's not just UNISA that uses a year and semester system, that we may find that the sector and its relationship, as we have spoken about strengthening the higher education system, the PSET system, then it can create a ripple effect. And finally, we have said to mediate some of these challenges has also been to creating a dispensation where students register for all the modules they plan to undertake, and ensuring that they then just focus on the learning process. And I think these three sets of argumentations are not meant to disrespect the legal arguments that have been proffered, but to also understanding the core modalities of teaching and learning and research-led processes that are aligned to the learning processes. So thank you very much, Chair. I hope with this summary, we may have tried to put quite a complex matter in somewhat brief way. Thank you.
Thanks, VC, through you, Chair. Advocate Manuela, if you can quickly come in and wrap up on the legal matters that were raised.
Thank you, Chairperson. First thing first, Chairperson, with respect to the appealing of 3.3, I have indicated that If one looks at the order in which the judge has framed it, one word is that the decision to scrap. And Chairperson, the university has not taken a decision to scrap the semester system and adopt the year system. So that is just but one aspect of the appeal. So the judge has reviewed the decision, which was not a decision, which decision was never taken. The other aspect that we also need to remember is that the entire issue of the once-off registration stems from the issue of COVID-19, which necessitated the extension of time, even for matriculations and also for registrations. So now, if it comes to the university, there will be still two examinations that will be written in a year. The university, when it takes that decision, which is a policy decision, was for the efficiency and effectiveness of running the academic year 2021 to the benefit of the students. Now, if we were to implement the 3.3 order, it will mean that examination will be written in May and June, while the actual registrations have closed on the 31st of March. The notional hours that the principal and vice chancellor has spoken about will not be met. And that means the processes of examination will not comply with the quality framework by the quality assurance authorities. So that is the reason that examination were extended beyond June and July, not because the semesters were scrapped. There won't be a first and second semester. So that is the reason that we said that needs to be appealed. The other issue, Chairperson, is the avoidance of judicial encroachment. There is a need for difference between judicial decisions, academic decisions, administrative decisions, and expert decisions. Here, the academics who are experts in the field of the quality of education have taken a decision to say, instead of writing examination in June, let's write examinations in September. And the other examination a few months after that, so that we could cover up, because we can cover the time that has been impacted or taken away by the extensions of registration, etc. So those are the points that I wanted to raise with regards to the appeal. The other issue that Chairperson of the committee raised is with regards to whether it was not possible to have an emergency meeting. Or the statutes of the university do allow that. Yes, indeed. The statutes of the university, more especially institutional statute 13 bracket 1, allows for extraordinary meeting. Extraordinary meeting, it's an emergency meeting. But under the circumstances, could it have been possible? The letter was written on the 28th of December. The statute requires an ordinary meeting to be held 7 days after an announcement. Now, if on the 28th, the statutory requirement was to call for the meeting, that meeting would have been on the 4th of January. And on the 4th of January, that was the expiry date of the time that was requested, was imposed by the minister. And that emergency meeting would not have been the final meeting, Chairperson. It would have been just but one meeting by the council, because the council would have to issue yet another time frame to call for a Senate meeting,
which will still require 7 days. So all in all, about 14 to 21 days were required in order to hold an emergency meeting. Henceforth, we say that it would not have been possible. And moreover, with regard to the argument, as the chairperson has indicated, what were the arguments? In summary, I would say that they were a trimetric argument. Trimetric argument in the sense that the three arguments that was presented by the parties, the minister, the EFF, and by UNISAM, were diametric or were trimetric argument in that they differed. For example, the minister argued that he is empowered by Section 42, brackets 1, to direct the university. But his direction was not that he was intending to withhold the funds. Now, the court said, if you direct and not intend to withhold the funds, what was the purpose of writing a letter? And now the EFF comes and says, the minister is not empowered by Section 421, and also is not empowered to withhold the funds. Now, the university's argument was that we did not want the minister to withhold our funds, which is 66 million, quite a huge amount of money, because we know that the minister has the power to do so. These were in totality the error in law, because the minister indeed did not have the power to direct, but he had the power to withhold. But before he had exercises that power to withhold, he will have requested UNISA to give a reasons why the money, the funds should not be withheld. That is the reason, Chairperson, that that portion of the judgment or that portion of the court order, we are not appealing at all. We are appealing the order which we say that is polycentric, because here the court, instead of giving us a judicial reason, it encroached in the policy-making decision of the university, which if it is not challenged, it will be a law in itself that all universities will have to look over their shoulder every time they take a policy decision which they deem fit in order to run and effectively the management of the university. So that is basically the point that I wanted to put forward, Chairperson, if I've covered everything that was raised by the honorable members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson of the committee. I think that's our response, all our responses from UNISA. Chairperson, thank you.
Yeah, okay. The throughput rates, nobody responded to that. Or unless I was distracted.
Vici, do you want to respond?
Yes, thank you very much. Chairperson of the portfolio committee. We truly recognize that advancing access with success is an important area. The students at UNISA, because of the comprehensive nature, have been registering in different ways. The first would be what we refer to as the full-time equivalent. These are the students who take the most maximum numbers of their modules and sometimes finish within the stipulated or what we refer to as record time. These are in undergraduate studies. The second aspect is those who adhere to this notion of lifelong learning or continuous learning. They work as they improve their qualifications. And sometimes the time or the period within which they invest in the learning process can be rather long. And we are trying to ensure that as part of these varied types of students, that we create stronger systems of student support in order that we don't let many students fall through the cracks. And part of this is reimagining the UNISA centers as sites of academic support and not just administrative support, as has been the case. And this reimagination is something that council, academics, administrative staff, and professional staff at UNISA recognize, because our level of dropout and of drop-off are quite high. The second part is precisely to ensure that we improve the quality of teaching, engage scholarship and research and innovation of the university, thus ensuring the quality of our students when they graduate. Is we are investing in the development of our academics in their pursuit for their PhD or the next professorate. Partly because we recognize that the numbers of academics with PhDs is rather not comparable or consonant within the higher education landscape in general, but also at UNISA, and it stifles supervisory capacity in postgraduate studies, or if not, it minimizes the student academic support that requires strengthening and therefore ensuring that our students pass. The other aspect, the chairperson of the committee and chair, is the multimodal or remote or open distance e-learning in its comprehensive aspect that UNISA uses as a model. And we recognize that if we have the requisite support of bridging the digital divide, the interventions that we could put in place would enable our students and would enable our students to participate optimally and therefore mediating and mitigating the nominal success or graduation rates that are recorded at UNISA. And therefore, I'm of the view that a chairperson of the portfolio committee and honorable members of the committee, if we look at these systems that we are putting in place, including enhancing our technologies so that they become enablers and levers of attending to varied divides or bifurcations, whether the urban-rural divide, the digital divide, the disciplinary separation. That is what we are setting ourselves as a university to ensuring from the lessons of the past, but also to the reimagination of the future, that we strongly work together as the different stakeholders within the university towards ensuring that our students succeed and they play meaningful roles in our country, in the continent, and in the globe. So these are the systems that we're putting in place, and with the support of council and with the support of yourselves and society, we hope that you will realize that we will be making this shift. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. VC, can we move to Dr. Tandi?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you also for the very important interventions and comments and thoughts of the portfolio committee members on this matter. I think it's been really helpful to listen to some of the thoughts and some of the very important points about the complex issues of enrollment, of access, of success, and also the matters relating to the planning of the system. And I just want to give some clarity on a couple of issues that were raised. One, just to say that I'm sorry that I can't give really more input on the legal matters and the legal approach. You know, in terms of the judgment, I think that's We are awaiting legal advice, and I don't want to jeopardize the minister's opportunity to engage with that legal advice on the judgment, which is still forthcoming. You know, I think that it would be correct to say that we are concerned, you know, as the chair has also indicated, about the possible consequences at a system level of the judgment, and what it might mean for the minister's ability to fund and steer the system in a way that is sustainable and that supports effective growth and capacity building of the system, and also in a way that is socially just and in line with government policy and intent. I'll come back to the issue of social justice as well. Maybe just to say, in terms of the issue of the directive, I think that we are, you know, I think that this is a useful discussion. We are engaging and will continue to engage with the university. Perhaps the intention to issue a directive could have resulted in further engagement, perhaps. I think the, you know, the response of UNISA was reflected that the university had, you know, in some ways shared some of the concerns of the minister. And you know, I think importantly in our presentation we outlined how much extensive engagement there has been. And I just want to make, you know, the commitment as well that we will continue to work closely with UNISA. This is something that we do with all our public institutions. And also to confirm that, you know, UNISA's leadership, as they have done today, has shown great willingness as well in engaging very openly with us on these issues. Just to clarify, in terms of the sanctions, the financial penalties kick in when there is either a 2% over or under enrollment on the enrollment plan by institutions. It applies to all institutions, and it's something that takes effect 2 years after the actual year of over enrollment because of the way in which the subsidy formula works and how it is allocated in terms of the teaching input. I just wanted to also talk about the issues of academic support and success. I think the VC has quite eloquently responded on that, and this is something that was raised quite significantly. Also to acknowledge that these issues were raised very eloquently in the SRC presentation as well. So questions around what the qualification pathways are for students and how do students actually access quality and meaningful pathways at institutions where they can articulate to other qualifications, but also where they can enter into employment. The issues around curriculum and pathway issues are actually critical parts of the enrollment planning process. The issue that has been raised around higher certificates, the kind of qualification roots of that, the exploration of whether foundation provision or truly foundational higher certificates is the way to go about things. These are, what does the cooperation with CVET mean? These are all very critical issues that have to be discussed as part of enrollment planning. And also separately, you know, relating to the issue of planning, how it is that we can support the growth of the TVET college system without overwhelming it, and through partnerships with institutions. But also this is a critical part of what the white paper on post-school education is saying, that we need to grow the TVET system. I just want to also pick up on the points around social justice, and yes, the concern about, from a planning point of view, how we grow the system, how we address the need for access and the growing demand for higher education. Very important points about the need for developing the whole PZ system. Minister has spoken on this many times. I think even earlier this week, he spoke very eloquently in the discussion on the APP and strategic plan of the department, the importance of growing the whole post-school system in line with the white paper. The minister and the department has the responsibility of strengthening and building and growing the whole system, not just universities and TVET colleges, but also ensuring the quality and sustainability of the system. And this is a critical point that I think many of the members of the portfolio committee also referred to. How do you ensure that we're addressing access effectively, but also meaningfully ensuring that from a social justice point of view, there's no point in allowing students to enter the university system without giving them effective routes to succeed and the appropriate support to do so. There's also a big social cost to success and to the throughput issues. And to be honest, there's also a big financial cost, and it's equally efficient to bring students into the system and not allow them to be able to complete, and we've got research that has shown this. So I just want to acknowledge that point about the broader planning of the system, particularly the point about post-COVID and how we can be more innovative and proactive around this. I think the Minister has also spoken to this. We do need to address new ways of teaching and learning and lots of issues that we need to plan for. But also we have to look at sustainability and appropriate funding. So with growth, looking at capacity development, maybe just to also address the fact that the costs of developing more blended and distance learning models are not necessarily at the upfront lower cost. In fact, at the outset, sometimes these are things that may require additional investment, you know, before economies of scale can be achieved. I know UNISA could talk to this, and many of the institutions can talk to this in terms of what was allowed last year. And then, Chair, sorry to take, I don't want to take any too much longer, but just to provide some clarity on the UNISA ministerial task team that has been mentioned. Just to say that, I mean, this task team was appointed by the Minister in 2020. It was announced, I think, in July. It started its work approximately in August. The task team is a small task team chaired by Dr. Vincent Mapai. It's busy concluding its work at the moment. Quite a significant task. And maybe to say that it's not that it's, the reason why it hasn't advised the minister yet is it is still has to provide that advice to the minister. Is it an independent review? And maybe just to quickly give you some sense of what the task team is looking at. Is it really a strategic review of the current vision and plans of UNISA as such a critical and important institution in our higher education system? And looking at the mandate of UNISA as an open and distance learning institution, what does this mean in the South African context? Looking also at some of the issues that have been raised here by the institution itself around the current systems and models at UNISA in terms of admission and enrollment, programs and qualifications, issues around quality of research and innovation, teaching and learning, and also looking at governance and administration models. Just to say some of the issues, of course, the issue of IT systems and the efficiency of those is also being looked at. So hopefully that task team will report soon to the minister, and hopefully then that strategic review may be able to feed into some of the broader system planning processes, but equally provide UNISA with, and of course it was, UNISA also had agreed, you know, that this strategic review would be helpful. So I think that it will also be very, hopefully be very helpful for the institution itself. Thanks, Chair. I hope I've answered some of the questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any comments from the students?
Thank you very much, Chair. I will just be quick. What I wanted when I raised the hand at the time was just to provide clarity to the comment made by Honorable Letsie on his deference to the point we made about higher certificates. So our position is that there should be two pathways to a degree. So the normative way of getting into a 4 or 3 year degree, and alternatively the institution introduces extended course program with special design to accommodate higher certificate students, which would mean that if you do not qualify for a degree, you enroll for extended course program. And what brings us to this position is due to the many engagements we had with the institution in trying to find a workable solution to the problem of higher certificate students. As it stands, we have a disturbing number of students who were rejected upon completing higher certificates, wanting to enroll for their degrees. So these students are expected to compete with external students, most coming from high school or other institutions next year. By virtue of that, and also taking into consideration the NQF level of higher certificate, they are at a disadvantage. So many will continue being rejected and struggle to be enrolled in other institutions or even find employment with that higher certificate. So as such, for us, higher certificate becomes a somewhat fundraising program. Although that is not the planning of the university, but it becomes that if you complete higher certificate, but you cannot use it for anything else. Hence, we say that higher certificate must be replaced or rather combined with a degree to make degrees for non-qualifying students who ordinarily do higher certificate to do a degree. So if you were doing a four-year degree, then you'd do five. We have not done extensive research on this proposal and are ready to work with the university on its practicality. But also, just as a close, Honorable Lissie also mentioned NSFAS and asked and posed a question about NSFAS. So we've indeed had numerous instances where NSFAS has said that they did not receive transcripts of students. And at times when we follow up, the university will say they did send those transcripts. Hence, in our presentation, we also made the point that there is a concerning poor coordination between UNISA and NSFAS. And it's one of the main challenges we wanted to get to the bottom of going forward in our time in NSRC. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Shatadi, for your comments and clarifications. I think earlier on, when I was handing over to the department, I incorrectly mentioned that Tandi is the acting DDG for university. For higher education. I was supposed to say for the university branch in the department. I noticed that I made that mistake, but that is a correct reference, Tandi. I think we've had a good discussion this afternoon about UNISA, the future of UNISA, the question of enrollment, and of course we reflected on the court case. I think we do appreciate that the leadership at UNISA is almost, at least those that we've interacted with today, it's a new leadership, from the chair of council to the vice chancellor. There might be others in the executive, senior management of the university who have been there before, but substantially the leadership is new. And with the new leadership, we expect that there should be fresh ideas, fresh impetus to the direction that the university has to take, and therefore there is much more expectation from our side on what that needs to happen there at the university. From our side, it's quite clear that this matter was not properly handled from the beginning. The issue of enrollment has not been properly handled. The under and over enrollment. At the end of the day, there are plans that we have to comply with, and there must be a reason why we don't comply with those plans. So the first over enrollment was not properly handled by the university. And the call has been to say, are there consequence management? Are there consequences for this type of decisions that gets done in an institution? Because without consequence management, institutions and organizations will continue to experience decline in the standards, in the performance, generally in doing things. So decay will begin to creep in. So it's going to be a free for all at some point. So it's important for people to be held accountable for whatever decisions that they take, whatever actions that happen there. And that's why there is a very firm call from our side that there must be consequences for this type of actions, which is something that is not coming up very strong. But I do take the point that the chair has made that there will be a submission. They are proposing to make a submission to us. Now, part of that submission must be to indicate what will be the consequences for the case. Because we are refusing to step off from this issue without understanding that what is it that it can that must be done so that it does not happen again. It does not happen again. You know, as a result of the over-enrollment, which created these difficulties, and then later on there was a letter to say don't enroll 20,000 and all of that, which was not supposed to happen, and which then became an issue for court now. And I'm sure that there are a lot of resources that were utilized there, a lot of money that was spent on this litigation, which could have been avoided. So we're still insisting that we need to get a sense of what is going to happen there. And we're asking that council must indicate to us exactly what is it that council is going to do so that this situation is avoided. I think as part of doing that, probably we can understand the chronology of this issue, what has happened, in much more precise terms than the superficial nature in which it was provided, because we did ask the question, what exactly led to this? And then we could not get a very exact response. So the chronology that we will get from the council as part of a consequence management and properly situating where the thing started and where it ended and what happened. So we'll emphasize on that. On that issue. There was a proposal by the presentation from UNISA that probably in light of this, going forward, there might be a need to still comply with the enrollment plan and to get the students who are in the plan to be enrolled, and those students will be fully funded by the fiscus. And then allow that there must be other students who must be admitted who may not necessarily be funded by the fiscus. I don't know how that one is going to work, but it does seem to be something that might have informed the decision to do this over enrollment. I'm making that assumption because it was not properly supported by, because it's quite a fundamental proposal, quite profound. So we need to understand what is the thinking, how is this going to work? Where is UNISA going to get the money to pay the students who are not paid by the system? And how do you determine, is it the first come, first serve, the first 500 will get funding from the state, and then after that, where are they going to get funding? Who's going to fund the students? So I think we will ask that the university properly substantiate this proposal, because I think it was not just made as a by the way. It's possible that it might have been considered. So we'd like that this proposal be properly made, motivated, comprehensive submission. And then there was an issue about the higher certificate. I think it's quite clear that finality is required on this issue. Because Professor Ndlovu says maybe these are the students who can be accounted for in the TVET because they increase the number. I don't know how many students are studying this certificate. It might be an issue where it creates a distortion in the system. So we will ask that as the students have also made that call, that this matter be discussed by UNISA, management and council, because it's an issue that requires probably Senate input, the academics internally, make an input on the relevance of these certificates and whether must it continue to be provided for by UNISA or whether UNISA can work with the TVET colleges to provide the certificate so that the students can be accounted by the TVET colleges, but still being provided through UNISA. Probably that is one of the ideas that can be applied. But so we are not, I don't think it's for us to say it must be done away with, it mustn't be done away with, because that decision must have been taken after proper application of the mind, after looking at it, and the university itself must say, no, we don't think that we should continue with this thing. So we're asking you to apply your mind on this and to get finality. But what the Secretary General of the SRC is saying, I think makes a lot of sense, because it does, it is supported by UNISA itself, by Professor Ndlovu submission. So I think those are the issues. Generally, sometimes you may get a sense that the portfolio committees itself is not at one about this issue, but when you listen to the input, there is a lot of convergence about what we say from across the parties, because parties will come and articulate their own policy perspective, some ideological perspective, but there is a bit of convergence in a sense that we are all not propagating for anarchy, because anarchy is when there is no management in the system, things just happen without planning and so forth. All of us recognize the importance of planning in the system, that there is a need for planning and those plans must be complied with, but also there is a need for the system to be expanded. How the system is expanded is a matter of debate by all of us, whether that capacity exists and how to expand the system. But access to higher education is not something that we are arguing against, even in this discussion. All what we are saying is that it must be done properly, it must be managed so that it creates sustainability, so that the system is not choked, so that it does not create impunity in the system whereby all the universities will start disregarding the plans that they have with the department. This is the call, I think. This is what makes all the views to converge around, to say let's protect the university system. A part of protecting it is to make sure that we do that. The issue of throughput, of success, is very important. I do take what the Vice Chancellor was saying, that some acknowledgement of this system, it's like saying it's inevitable that the level of throughput is not going to be as high. Well, that's accepted, but what it is currently is very, very low, as I understand. It's very, very low, and I think it's a point that you also need to go back and work on. Otherwise, we've had a very good engagement. There are comments there. I'm not able to read all of them. But we have had good engagement with UNISA. The chairperson at the beginning did say that they don't like to see themselves coming in front of us, because those that we call to parliament are They are not necessarily coming to present a good story. You'll be surprised, Chair, that we also want to create a platform where good stories within the higher education system can be articulated through us. We did so with the UniZulu, for instance, which Honorable Litsia was talking about. So it's not that we call only those who are seen to be have done something wrong, but we also want to engage and share experiences of the good things that are happening. So next time when we call you, don't think that we are calling you because there's something wrong that UNISA has done. But I think what underlines your point is that this leadership must turn the corner there. This leadership must look after that prestigious institution of our people and make sure that things are done properly there. We don't get to experience the kind of things that we normally get, and the negative publicity also. I think with that, I would like to thank you, all of you, the Chair and the Vice Chancellor and your team, the Honorable Members, the Department as always, and the student leadership. Thank you very much for the engagement. This meeting is adjourned.
Long live the chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Long live the chair.
I was saying.